Okay, today we're talking about Ihara Saikaku's Life of a Sensuous Woman, right? The passage that's in your text. It's about a quarter to a third of a longer work where it's kind of more of the same, more of these episodic events that we walk through this woman's life. And I hope you looked at before you read it or after you read it, you looked at the Yoshiwara, the floating world webpage, because that explains kind of Ihara Saikaku's success and why he's writing about most of the work he wrote, Life of an Amorous Man, Life of an Amorous Woman. This gets translated as Life of a Sensuous Woman here. Five Women Who Loved Love, The Barrelmaker Brimful of Love. They all deal with kind of just right on the edge of something prurient, right? Not quite overtly sexual, but pretty close. Because he's writing in this, at the time when the middle class begins to rise, as it says in that Yoshiwara page, that this idea that you know, reading, as I'm sure you can attest, takes a long time to do, right? Especially if the language is unfamiliar, you're not good at it, right? You can read faster, but it takes practice. Most people, you know, certainly before 17th century Japan, and we consider the same thing for Europe as well, most people just don't have the time to read. So literacy was not a big deal. But with the rise of a middle class, right, the rise of a merchant class in Japan first, basically, and in Europe a little bit later, people begin to have leisure time and they begin to read. But they don't want to read what's out there when, like, literacy starts to become, get greater penetration in the society. They don't want to read fables and myths and history and stories about kings and princesses. There are only two things they want to read about. They want to read about themselves, because let's face it, we like to hear about ourselves, and they want to read about something that's interesting to them. Well, what's universally interesting to most people? Sex. And that boy, Ihara Saikaku, he just plays right into that from a very odd beginning, right? His first big hit, I think it's on his introductory page, his first big collection, right, the 1,000-verse Renga in mourning for the death of his daughter, the death of his wife, was such a big hit, right, and actually he was totally unaware of that it became a big hit, that he thought, he came back and after 2 years wandering as a wandering beggar throughout Japan to realize that he was a literary sensation, and he thought, I'm going to give the people what they want. At the time, as you know, Yoshiwara became a big thing. So we get this rise of the middle class. We have this interest in sexuality. But we also have, as that Yoshiwara page says, this tension between the bonzes, the Buddhist priests, who still hold great power in Japan, and the shogunate, basically the question, let's say a separation of church and state is problematic then. At that time. And Saikaku acknowledges that in all of his work. He starts out and interjects these kind of little moral aphorisms that appease the censors, basically, right? Oh, well, look, he's telling this terrible story about all this sex and this woman using her sexual power. But he's saying, he's telling us this because he wants to warn us that this is what women do. That kind of stuff like that, right? So Saikaku, in obliging them, we do this. We'll talk about that first line in a second. Let's talk about the bulk of the story and how that gets set up, right? That first, a beautiful woman, many ages have agreed, is an axe that cuts down a man's life. Well, to be honest, that doesn't really connect with the bulk of the text here. In fact, doesn't connect. I've read the not just these excerpts, but the entire novel, and it doesn't connect with the novel at all. It's a great aphorism. It's truly a sexist, right, misogynist kind of notion that women will be the death of men, right, especially a beautiful woman, right? And the idea that many ages have agreed this only just serves to kind of highlight this received idea of the patriarchy that comes upon us, right? A beautiful woman is an axe that cuts down the man's life. But, you know, the temple priest reading that say, oh, yes, he's giving us advice here. Of course we know that. That's why we remain celibate. But take a look at it. Let's get beyond that and look at the whole setup, right? So we've got a narrator here who starts by telling us that he follows these two men and he overhears their conversation. And he hears their conversation, one of whom says, you know, I wish I never got involved with people, right? He's a misanthropist, not necessarily a misogynist, but a misanthropist, right? I don't want any relationships. Life would be so much simpler if just everyone was alone. His guy, his partner, on the other hand, his buddy he's traveling with, and notice physically that they're totally distinct from one another as well. But the guy he's traveling with says, not me, man. I tell you what, you know how I want to go? I want to go in the middle of having sex all the time, right? In fact, there's that great euphemism. He's like, I want to die with my pledging liquid, he says, which I think you could pretty much figure out that pledging liquid, which is was a very common euphemism in Japan at that time, right? It's ejaculation was the way a man pledged his love to a woman, right? These two people, right, both totally unrealistic, totally hyperbolic, define kind of the edges of the spectrum of all human experience. They represent the breadth of human experience, and they define these impossible opposites. All of us listeners, fit somewhere in between those two people. We realize you cannot exist totally alone. Right? It just doesn't work, right? One of the things that makes us human is interaction. But you also can't go jumping from bed to bed to bed to bed to bed to bed to bed. You're gonna get shot, or you're gonna realize the emptiness and futility of that life as well. But I think that's there. I think that those are there. And they go, and they get this story told to them by this old woman who is in a hermitage. And we'll come back to that hermitage at the very end. So look at us, where we are as readers, when we look at this. We're being told a story from a narrator who is overhearing it from these two guys who themselves are hearing it from the woman, who herself is talking about ages long past, right? She's not talking about her contemporary life and what she did yesterday. She's talking about when she was a young girl, 50, 60, 70 years ago, right? And then working her way up, and she never really does get to her considerable old age until the very end. So we're at a distance both in time and in place and in person. We're four levels removed from the action that we're reading, because it's the old lady telling the two guys, over being overheard by the narrator, who happens to be telling us. That's a lot of distance, and there's a lot of room for error there, and a lot of room for interpretation there. And what I think Saikaku is signaling to us is we need to be aware of different levels within the text. That aphorism, for instance, a beautiful woman, many ages have agreed, is an axe that cuts down a man's life. And there are a couple more in here. That's a completely different level, right? Meant for something completely different than our entertainment, right? But if we even just focus on the woman's story, we see that, yes, she starts out from kind of humble beginnings, right? Not quite poor, but, you know, part of this rising middle class. But she's able to use her beauty to elevate herself from this fairly humble beginnings. So is that a form of power? Maybe. I mean, she gives the audience what it wants, right? And so she rises up, but she finds the love of her life, then she loses him, right? And I think it's interesting we get that little vignette that where she finds the real power, where she really starts to begin her climb, is in literacy, is in writing letters. Again, not a very, well, literacy was on the rise, but I mean, this was a fairly serious occupation, letter writer, to express for someone something they couldn't express for themselves, to put it in text so that someone else can read it at a distance. And in a way, here's a different level, Saikaku's reflecting on his own status. He went from, you know, an okay poet who was barely getting by to nationally renowned poet to then internationally renowned author, novelist, right? Because he had his finger on the pulse of what was going on. So maybe this is Saikaku talking about himself too. But he's also, along the way, giving us through this woman's story, showing us the many levels of Japanese Edo society at the time. We got the young samurai, we got where she starts, right, at home, that kind of middle class household, right? We got the people of the streets, the young samurai, we got the domain lord, sometimes translated as the provincial lord, the monks, the abbot, the bonzes, the wandering mendicants, the shogunate itself, right? We get all of these things here. And through all of them, right, for good or ill, our old woman survives by using not just her beauty, but her intelligence as well. She's really, in fact, I'd like to think that she uses her intelligence more than she uses her beauty. And it's kind of the standard trope that, you know, beauty fades, but intelligence doesn't, right? I think on one level then, Saikaku is showing us the position of women at this time in Japan, that they have to kind of dance to a tune that they did not write. That's the position of everywhere except one place, except Yoshiwara, where women were the equal of men. In fact, certainly the geisha houses and then the courtesan houses and then even the whorehouses, and there's a distinction between those three different levels, right? One, you rent somebody's body. Another, you rent somebody's time. And the third, you pay for the pleasure of her company. And there's no sex involved. And that's the height. That's the geisha, right? But the bars, right? Women could own all those joints. The bars, the theaters, the commedia dell'arte groups, right? The stores there. Everyone was treated as an equal. If you were the poorest farmer from north of Japan, from Hokkaido, right, and you had enough money to get there, and the shogun himself showed up the same night in Yoshiwara, you would both be treated the exact same way. Because what mattered was you were all equal until the money ran out. As long as you had the money to pay for it, you were equal. Male, woman, young, old, right? High class, low class, no class at all. All that mattered, well, economically, was the money. But what really happens socially is everybody gets to intermingle and everybody is treated the same, unlike anywhere else in Japanese society at that time. The woman in this text, she gains and loses power. She's abused by both men and women, but she makes her own choices as much as she can, right? And that seems to be a form of power. Now, granted, those choices are tempered, and sometimes they're limited, but sometimes they're not limited just by gender, but they're limited by circumstance of birth. They're limited by elevation, right? We still have the high and low class is still just as much an issue, in fact, if not more of an issue, than gender at this time. So we have to ask ourselves, is this a text about how women are mistreated and powerless? or about how women have great power if they're willing to use it. And I think you can argue either side. I mean, I think there's evidence in the text. I think if you take certain specifics, you can argue that women are powerless. I think if you take a larger scope, you can argue that women have power, right? These stories, they move from terrible places to beautiful palaces over and over again, right? And back and forth to huge monasteries, to individual priest cells, right? But they all end in one spot, the spot that the frame story takes place in. And that spot is the hermitage, the place where she ultimately ends up alone. And I don't want to claim any existential concerns for Saikaku, but I have to say that she's alone and she's waiting for death, and she's even starting to spout those aphorisms that we see at the beginning that just don't fit. And maybe that's the wisdom she comes to at the end of her life. But I think that in the end, no matter the power, no matter the looks, no matter the fame, no matter the experiences, we all end up in the same situation. Some of us can pass on our stories and our wisdom or even our foolishness, and some of us don't, but we all end up the same place, don't we? No matter the love, no matter the wealth, we all end up alone, dying, and dead, right? 6 feet under the ground. There's no distinction there. And to be honest, Saikaku himself doesn't make that overt. He's not beating you over the head with that. He's just leading you to it, right? If you follow the chain of her events, right? And she's with our two listeners there. We hear her talking to the whole world, to the whole experience, to all of human experience. And Saikaku, or the narrator's not Saikaku himself, but let's pretend it, that he is, this persona that he's created. Right? The narrator relays it to us because this is perhaps the lesson we need to learn, right? That we will, Deo Volens, God willing, end up old, or at least older than we are now, maybe wiser, maybe not as good looking. Yeah, but there's recompense for that. There's old age can give us something else. Perhaps it's wisdom, perhaps it's resignation, but the inevitable will ultimately come for us, and that is where the text really leaves us. And I guess that's where I'll really leave you.